From Nevada to Minnesota, Mississippi to Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, chants of "Drain the Swamp" echo throughout Donald Trump's campaign rallies. In his new book, Swamp Wars, author and national political commentator Jeff Lord details the ongoing battle between the swamp and America. He is here to talk about it. The USA has hit its debt limit and Congress must take action. Of course, Congress also should be working on a new budget. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. It seems like only bad news makes the news, but Eric Boehm finds out from Ron Bailey at Reason Magazine, we are actually living in the best of times. And raising the minimum wage is a major policy goal of the left, but doing so would result in the loss of thousands of such jobs. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Swamp Wars is the title of Jeff Lord's latest book. As a former CNN commentator who was a victim of the left's attack on those who oppose it, he offers a firsthand account of the battle between real America and the media government swamp. Jeff also writes frequently for the American Spectator. Jeff, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jeff, you have your latest book out. It's called Swamp Wars. We've all heard the term swamp, but tell us what you mean by swamp wars.
Well, in 1964, if you'll recall, actor Ronald Reagan made his debut on national television with a speech for Barry Goldwater. And in that speech, he talked about who was going to run our lives. He says, are we going to be governed by a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital? Well, what he was really talking about there was what has become known as the swamp. And my point is that swamps today, Washington, D.C. is without doubt the capital of the swamp, but swamps today are all around the country and for that matter around the world. And they are composed of a group of intellectual elites who see themselves as intellectually and morally superior to the average American, particularly to President Trump and most particularly to his supporters. And so these swamp wars break out all the time. The number one swamp war is, of course, targeting the president. And they want to impeach him. They want this. They want to investigate him. They want this, that, and the other thing. But around the country, it could be Hollywood. It could be the media in general. It could be academia. When you see somebody like, say, Ben Shapiro show up to give a speech and they've got to call out the National Guard or the local police and all of this sort of thing to protect him. I think at Berkeley it cost the college something like $600,000 for security. I myself gave a talk, was invited by the college Republicans at Franklin and Marshall, where I am an alum, to give a talk, and we had about 200 kids show up, and I was no sooner out of the car than I was given not one, not two, not three, but four security guards.
Oh, gee.
Who were positioned in various places in the auditorium and close to me while I gave my talk and took questions and answers. And then when it was done, they escorted me out and to the car. Well, you know, you're just saying to yourself, what is going on here with all of this?
Well, Jeff, what is going on here with all of this? I mean, let's face it. Every president has folks who intensely dislike him.
Right.
Regardless of what president and what period of time, it's always been a blood sport. This, however, at least in the modern era, what is it about the left that makes their hatred of this president, this president's policies, this president's supporters so visceral?
Well, I've written about this in the book, and I date this to the confirmation of Robert Bork.
Mm-hmm.
When I was then a young White House aide in the White House political office, the Reagan White House political office. And there was this furious battle which Bork lost and which I have to say the Reagan White House was not prepared for because Supreme Court nominations previous to that were gentlemanly, scholarly, polite affairs, sort of abstruse and listening to legal theory and all this. And this was a pitch battle. It was the first time television commercials had been run against a Supreme Court nominee. And in this case, it was with the inimitable voice of the actor Gregory Peck warning about the dangers of Robert Bork. Robert Bork himself later wrote that this was a battle about more than a single judge. He says that the reason for the vociferousness of this and the viciousness was this was about not just political control but cultural control of the country, and that they saw Robert Bork as a threat to that control. And I would suggest that they look at Donald Trump and his supporters as a threat to their control of American culture. And the irony, of course, is that Donald Trump came out of media culture, you know, with his television shows. I mean, he like Ronald Reagan was very much a creature of this, and so they utterly detest him, and particularly his supporters. And this really is what this is all about. And in the book, I have a quote from a Washington Post story, as this was slowly beginning to dawn on journalists, mainstream journalists in 2016. And they talked to a woman whose name I believe was Kathy Culbertson, something like that. She was from Ohio, had retired to North Carolina. When she was in Ohio, she worked at an unnamed university. And she goes on at length in this article and says, we couldn't say Merry Christmas. We couldn't use he and she or him and her as pronouns. Yeah. She goes through this whole list of things and she says everybody was on walking on eggs because people would say they'd been insulted. And she said – and then she paused and said, but no one worried about insulting me. And that explained why they found her at a Trump rally in North Carolina and was a thoroughgoing Trump supporter. And I think right there you've got this. That I mean, even Bill Maher, whose show I've now been on twice, has said that liberals had better get wise to the fact that political correctness is damaging them.
Well, it really is. We are talking with Jeff Lord, and Jeff is author of the new book, Swamp Wars, and we'll discuss in a couple of minutes where you can go to get a copy of it. But Jeff, you were perhaps the earliest person in the media to really identify Donald Trump as someone who could be the leader of this movement. As you just pointed out, he was in the media, so most people didn't expect that that person could become the leader of a populist movement.
Right.
You early on identified him as that, wrote at least one book on the subject. What was it back in 2014, 2015, early 2016 that you saw in Donald Trump that caused you to think that he would become what it is he has become?
I wrote my first column, Never Ignore Donald Trump, in June of 2013 in the American Spectator. And the point I was making was that he had right before then been on Fox and Friends. And he was saying somebody needs to come along, whether it's me or someone else, and straighten out this country. And I said, you know, not only yes, but H-yes. And I said in the Reagan White House, we had a slogan on the staff, let Reagan be Reagan. Mm-hmm. And I said, the answer here is let Trump be Trump. And that is more or less exactly what happened. I'm told that my friend Corey Lewandowski would later have exactly those words in this campaign war room in Trump Tower, let Trump be Trump. And that is exactly why he got elected, because he is the least politically correct person you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And in the style I have, most of my extended family is from New York, Eastern Long Island and upstate New York, et cetera. And as I well know, New Yorkers can be blunt.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And so what you're seeing here, I think, is this unusual combination that people didn't realize at first, which is, number one, he's a kid from Queens. Mm-hmm. And he grew up with his father taking him to all of these construction sites where the father was a developer and all this sort of thing. So he hung out with the hard hats. and all this, and really got to like them and know them and spend time with them. And then when he became successful in business and he became a sort of star in the media, this is before The Apprentice, he really got to know the American media very well. I mean, he not only was featured in the sort of the usual places like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, but he was front page tabloid fodder.
A lot.
for all these kind of things. And it gave him, I think, a very keen understanding of the American media. So you add those two things together, and with his very blunt message about and he said to me, I interviewed him in 2014, and I still have this on tape, and I quoted at length in the book. He went on that if he ran, he would have the slogan, "Make America Great Again."
We have been talking with Jeff Lord, who is author of the new book, Swamp Wars. And Jeff, I'm sure many of our listeners are going to want to read this book, so where can they find it?
You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can find it in your local Barnes & Noble bookstore, and I hope you do.
Amazon.com. The book, again, is Swamp Wars. We've been talking with author Jeff Lord. Jeff, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Loman.
At the offices of the Club for Growth, Scott Parkinson is keeping an eye on Congress, something that certainly needs to be done. The summer silly season in full gear in July, but setting aside all of the theatrics that have occurred, we have some serious financial matters to deal with. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin a couple weeks back, Scott, indicated that we have already hit the nation's debt limit and something needs to be done sooner rather than later. Can you explain for us what the lay of the land is there?
On March 1st, there was a suspension of the debt limit that ended. The debt limit had been basically ignored for about a year through statutory authority that Congress gave Treasury to basically incur debt to a date certain, which was March 1st. That date passed, so Treasury had to enter into what's called extraordinary measures. During extraordinary measures, Treasury can sell various assets that it controls in order to meet our month-to-month debt obligation. And what's happened now is Secretary Mnuchin is looking at the way that revenue is coming into the Treasury Department. He's looking at the obligations that we have throughout the summer and the early fall, and he notified Congress and Nancy Pelosi that he expects extraordinary measures to be exhausted prior to Congress returning after Labor Day. So he is now calling on Congress to have completed the debt limit situation prior to leaving for the August recess.
As we look at that, this is part of ongoing budget tribulations that occur in Congress. And we are now headed into a time of year where is there not a deadline of October 1st for a new budget to be put into place? And Scott, what do you think are the chances that might actually happen this year?
The fiscal year ends on September 30th. Without a new spending deal on September 30th, Congress would once again incur a partial federal government shutdown. What that means is that only essential operations continue, and you see a lot of furloughed workers. We've had a couple of shutdowns in recent years over the funding of Obamacare, over President Trump's quest to get more money for border security and immigration enforcement. And so really what we're at here is almost a crisis of leadership on Capitol Hill. The inability repeatedly to meet our obligations underneath the law related to the federal budget process and the appropriations has been ignored now for a couple of decades. For the most part, what Congress does is they consolidate all 12 different appropriation bills into one or two really big bills that spend $1.2 to $1.3 trillion. And these omnibus legislation packages usually pass at a political pressure point when they can extract pain out of members that are fearing their own reelection. So that's why you see a lot of these big spending negotiations occur during the federal holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, and sometimes in the spring during Easter. Members of Congress, it's no secret that they do like to spend time with their family. A lot of them are actually normal people and not totally political robots. And so they have a strong desire to to get out of town and spend the holidays with their family. The congressional leadership tries to make this as hard as possible for people to oppose, and that's why they'll eventually try to set up a spending deadline for December. I think what we'll see in September, looking ahead, is a situation where Congress will go ahead with a short-term continuing resolution, and a continuing resolution in Washington is known as a CR. The CR would spend at current levels and maintain current policy riders that are included in our appropriation bills, sort of like the Hyde Amendment related to abortion funding. And the CR would probably, if I'm looking at my calendar here, if I had to guess, I'd say they'd put it either at Friday, December 13th or Friday, December 20th. And that way, there's a big Friday vote prior to our members of Congress and the House and Senate leaving Washington for Christmas.
And, of course, the public not paying particularly much attention to Washington at that time of the year either. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And, Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members of the Club for Growth. And I encourage everybody to actually just check us out on our website, clubforgrowth.org. You can become a member of the Club for Growth for free. And if you like what you see, why don't you follow us on Twitter, too? Our Twitter handle is at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, looking forward to talking with you again next week.
Okay, take care. Thank you.
The world is really not that bad of a place, at least when you put it into historical perspective. To hear some good news, we turn to Eric Boehm and Ron Bailey of Reason Magazine.
You know, we don't talk about good news on the news or on the radio much at all. It seems like we are obsessed with bad news and outrage. And of course, we have an internet and a media culture that just sort of feeds that to you on a silver platter all the time. You have to go looking for the good news, but there's actually a lot of it there. And some of it is what we're going to talk about today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. You're listening to American Radio Journal. And my guest today is Ron Bailey. He is the science correspondent for Reason Magazine. He's a friend of the show. He's been here several times before, but I don't know, Ron, that we've ever had the opportunity to talk about something as just wholesomely uplifting and positive as your latest piece in the magazine, which we'll get to in just a second. First of all, thanks for taking some time and being here with us today.
I'm delighted to be with you again. One of the things about the news is news is stuff that breaks or happens fast, and progress and good news is stuff that happens slowly. And so people pay attention to the bad news and forget to appreciate the good news, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think we totally agree about that, Ron. And that's exactly why I wanted to have you on here to talk about this piece that you've just written for the magazine. And really, this is just the best of good news. You look at the sort of four villains that have been stalking humanity throughout its history, the literal four horsemen of the apocalypse: war, famine, pestilence, and death. Humanity, we haven't defeated any of them, but we are, as you put it, we are pushing them back. They are all on the retreat at the moment. Let's start with the big guy, the one that's the most difficult to outrun, that's impossible to outrun, I guess, in the long run. Right now, humans are living longer than they ever have before. That's not just in America or in Europe or in the developed world. This is a global phenomenon.
That's absolutely correct. Throughout most of human history, the average life expectancy was somewhere around 30 years, and that was largely because a third of all children died before their fifth birthday from all kinds of horrible diseases and so forth. And at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, 1900 or so, average life expectancy on planet Earth was still somewhere around 30 years or so. But now it's over 72 years on average. It's more than doubled over the course of the last century or so. And that is, of course, extremely good news.
Unfortunately, we don't have time to go through in detail through each of the other three horsemen. There's just a ton of statistics and data in this piece, Ron. Quickly summarize for us, if you will, war, famine, pestilence. What's the best argument that humanity is winning against all three of them right now?
Well, the thing about interpersonal violence, war, if you will, is that actually the global murder rate is way down as well over the last 30 years or so, which surprises people. And the number of battle deaths since peaking after World War II in the 1950s are down 95% over that period of time as well. So your chances of being killed by your fellow human beings is the lowest probably it's ever been in all of human history. With regard to famine, undernourishment rates are way, way, way down. 40 years ago, it was about 40% of people were undernourished, and now it's below 10% of people on planet Earth. And a lot of that is because of still, unfortunately, some terrible regimes starve their people and so forth, and there's civil wars occasionally. And that maintains that. Otherwise, it'd be even better than it is. And then, of course, the defeat of all kinds of infectious diseases through vaccination, sanitation, and pure water is an amazing accomplishment as well. Basically, as I document fairly well, I think here is the pestilence, war, famine, and death are all on retreat.
And if you're listening, I really encourage you to check out this piece at Reason.com. The Impending Defeat of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse is the title, authored by Ron Bailey, who we are speaking with here. Ron is the science correspondent for Reason Magazine. And Ron, this piece, like I said, it's just really full of all these sorts of statistics and data points that show, in fact, the world is getting better. So listeners, you know, your friends are saying, oh, everything is terrible, everything is awful. You can pull this up. You can say, no, look at this. People are living longer, fewer infectious diseases, fewer wars, less likely to be killed by another human being. These are all good signs. Look, not everything is great. We live in a fallen world. There are certainly plenty of problems still remaining to be solved, but it's always good to feel like you've got at least a bit of a handle on some of these really big ones. And that brings me back, Ron, to really where we started this conversation. We were talking about it, and you mentioned that we're sort of hardwired to look at the bad news first and foremost. Why is that, do you think? And I know you get into this a little bit in the piece. Why does humanity in general, this isn't just a phenomenon created by Twitter or a phenomenon created by the 21st century, we tend to just see the glass as being half empty. Why is that?
There are basically a few psychological glitches. One, of course, is that we hear bad news all the time, and therefore we make the mistake of thinking that's what's really going on in the world. That's called the availability bias. The other thing is that as things improve, we change the baseline. We forget how bad things were and basically maintain, if you will, a certain level of disgruntlement, despite the fact that everywhere around us things are getting better. And then, of course, there's the psychological function of the fact that we are the descendants of people who, when they were running around in the savannas of Africa, if they heard a rustle in the wind and dismissed it and it turned out to be a lion, then they got eaten and they're not our ancestors. So we're the descendants of the people who, whenever they heard a rustle in the reeds, ran away. So they're always looking out for the bad news as opposed to the good news. So that's why we still attend that way those are the reasons why most people don't, in fact, recognize all the progress that has been going on over the last centuries.
Yeah. You know, I never really thought about the evolutionary aspect of that. I think that's a good point, Ron. I mean, our ancestors had a lot more to fear than we do, but we maybe have that sort of that thing kind of genetically hardwired into us to just be a little bit fearful all the time. That is, I guess, something you have to fight against. One of the things that we've also developed as humans is the capacity to reason, the capacity to think through, not just experience the fear, but to realize that it's not just bad things coming at us, but actually we live in a pretty good time as well. We are unfortunately out of time for today, but Ron Bailey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I hope that your listeners will take some time to appreciate all the good that's happening to them.
And again, that is Ron Bailey, Reason Magazine's science correspondent. You can check out his latest piece at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Raising the minimum wage would result in many of those jobs being eliminated and reduced hours for thousands more. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Cries of increasing the minimum wage to $15 per hour are emanating from virtually every Democratic candidate in the 2020 election cycle. Not to be outdone, Seattle's minimum wage increased on January 1, 2019 to $16 per hour for large employers, $15 per hour for employers with less than 500 employees, and $12 per hour for all other employees. The emotions on this issue obviously run deep. The impact of the decisions in the minimum wage debate will be felt by the most vulnerable for generations to come. I know because my first job out of college was in a minimum wage job. The argument advocated predominantly to raise the minimum wage relate to the argument that one cannot live on the current minimum wage of $7.25 an hour nationally. Few believe that one can live on $7.25 an hour, but the logical consequence of the cost of living argument translates into an argument that one's living costs are somehow the employer's responsibility. The argument defies economic logic and reality. If an employer is responsible for giving a living wage, as they call it, perhaps the minimum wage should be redefined as the personal budget you provide your employer annually, which the employer must cover. Every employee would then be paid according to their personal cost of living. Virtually everyone would understand and recognize that this idea is absolutely ludicrous and not economically sustainable, but then so is the cost of living argument supporting the request to hike the minimum wage. If you ever have been poor, and I have, you quickly appreciate the lure of raising your pay. What a way to get out of financial problems comes to mind first. Then reality sets in, and this reality is the harshest for the most vulnerable. During a run for the Pennsylvania State Legislature, to which I was elected, I was asked by a very dear friend after Mass two questions. The first question was, do you support raising the minimum wage? And the second was, if you do not support raising the minimum wage, would you feel the same way if it was you that was earning that amount? I indicated that I did not support raising the minimum wage and that my reasons for not supporting the minimum wage were numerous. The feel-good aspect of minimum wage is almost irresistible, but at the same time, the public policy aspect of it can be unbelievably damaging to the very poor you are attempting to help. It was obvious that the economics of how employers make employment decisions was not clear to the public in general. The marketplace determines minimum wage, not the government. Governments can dictate a minimum wage, but the marketplace will determine whether or not it will be paid. The basic building block of whether any wages can be paid to anyone is dependent upon whether the customer is willing to pay it. The customer ultimately determines how much anyone can be paid. Once past the customer decision, the marketplace, whether you believe in the free market or not, will determine whether the pay scale you offer is sustainable. Black markets flourish when governments attempt to assert their will over the will of the marketplace. Many of the unintended consequences of minimum wage legislation can be destructive to both the employee and the community. For instance, an increase in the minimum wage may cause an employer to determine if the employee's value is worth the cost. If what you are paid is not offset by the value to the customer of what you're doing, your job simply goes away. On a larger scale, minimum wage also significantly adversely affects rural communities over urban communities. Quite simply, $15 per hour in a rural area is significantly different than $15 per hour in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, or Los Angeles. Attempting to establish a national standard penalizes lower-cost communities, such as rural communities, compared to their urban counterparts. In effect, minimum wage legislation harms employees and employers in less populated areas, even though their cost of living is significantly less. Minimum wage legislation is also tremendously discriminatory to younger workers. It increases the cost to a prospective employer to hire someone with little to no experience, such that the employer is significantly less willing to risk hiring a person with little to no experience. Labor force participation for those from ages 16 to 19 has dropped from 52.7% in 1994 to 34% in 2014. The consequences of this dramatic reduction will be felt in the marketplace and the workforce and their lives for decades to come. Many employers that I deal with lament the fact that younger people who have not had the benefit of working part-time jobs while in high school are coming into the workforce with little to no job skills, making them almost unemployable by the time they're in their mid-20s. An entry-level job is designed to give experience, not just income. The net result is that many employers are now offering unpaid internships to prospective employees rather than paying jobs because of the minimum wage legislation, which increases costs with little apparent increase in value. The danger with feel-good legislation is that it does not feel good when it backfires. The greatest gift we can give to a new worker is to give them skills that will last them a lifetime, not just a paycheck that will last a weekend. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCNW-AM in Kansas City, Missouri, WWNL-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with WBRI-AM in Indianapolis, Indiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program.
Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.